Welcome to C2Y Podcast, Discussions on Child and Youth Care. My name is Wolfgang Vashaw. The podcasts I posted on August 15th were interviews with young people in Jordan who were protesting the conditions for youth in care and upon leaving care. I was informed about this protest by Dr. Rawan Ibrahim. Dr. Ibrahim is a service provider, having worked as a director of a youth care home, a researcher, a strong advocate for the rights of young people in care, and as one of only four people in Jordan to receive a PhD in social work. Her thesis was on youth transitioning out of care in Jordan. Welcome, Rawan.
Hi, Wolfgang.
Hi. 3 days after the protest started at Fourth Circle in Amman, Jordan, the police broke it up.
Yes.
Right after the circle was cleared, the young people held a press conference. You attended that press conference. What was said at the press conference?
Well, they were reiterating what they were calling out for. And other than that, they were also very disappointed and very angry about how they were treated. There was absolutely no need to disrupt the protest. And they wanted to make it clear that this is not going to deter them and that they're going to continue. And they did continue for some time after that, but at a different circle.
How were they treated that they were responding to?
I got different views. During the press conference, a lot of them claimed that they were beaten and, the police was, they were very cruel to them and calling them all sorts of names. And then other people told me that some young people, yes, indeed, they were maltreated, but others were not maltreated at all. So other young people believed that some of them were exaggerating. But in either case, I disagree with removing them. They pose no threat.
Yes, they seemed incredibly polite and respectful. And
yes.
There was no subtle or overt forms of violence at all that I saw.
Yes. And regardless of how exaggerated some of their claims are legitimate.
Which claims are you referring to?
Well, the main ones are health insurance, help in employment, housing, and especially the identification number on the national ID cards.
The identification number was something that came up repeatedly when I was speaking to young people. Could you explain a little bit more about what they were referring to?
Yes. In Jordan, it's mandatory by law for all Jordanian citizens to have a national ID card from the age of 16. And all of us are given national ID numbers. So those national ID numbers have a certain sequence. So, for example, what year were you born, Wolfgang?
I was born in 1970.
Okay. So your ID would start out with 970, and then the number 2, and then whatever serial number. Whereas for a group of these young people, their ID number actually starts out with 2000. So there are two different groups of Jordanians who are given that ID number. One, expats who have claimed their Jordanian nationality from the year 2000, from the year 2000 onwards, or not until the year 2000. And then another group is part of the young people who have been in care and unfortunately were not registered at birth. So when there was a committee that was investigating the conditions of the young people, they were the ones that actually found out that a number of them who were born to unknown families, were not even registered at birth, they didn't have birth certificates. And so when that was found and they informed the civil status department, these young people had already missed out on the sequence, on the serial number that's given to all people, so they had to create a new one. And they included them with the 2000. So even though it's given to expats, the young people with those ID numbers did not know that it was given to expats. So, of course, they feel very stigmatized because they feel that it's only given to them. But I mean, even if it's given to other people, it's not their fault that they weren't registered, and they should find a solution for this. Because now it's becoming increasingly known that young people from unknown families have the 2000 ID number.
So an employer will see that ID number and make some determinations about that. And so why would the employer care whether the person was brought up in care or not?
Well, the number, first of all, is odd. So that's going to raise questions. Yes, your average citizen does not know that expats were given that number. Probably expats themselves don't realize it. So it's going to raise questions. But anyhow, the employer might raise that question because a lot of them actually think that that ID is fake. So when they start posing questions to the young people have to actually tell them, you know, the truth. And that can also be very stigmatizing.
Right. And so there's concerns about the young people, there's forgery, they're not having the right number, the person starts to ask questions, and then the person finds out that this person lived in care.
Yes.
So what? Why does that matter to an employer?
It depends on the employer. It's a bit of a hit or miss, because there are two main views towards young people in care. And this stems from our cultural views. One is that our culture basically, in terms of the attitude towards young people, it's like two faces of a coin. One can be a very supportive face, and then another one can be sort of like a law enforcer judge. So for those who are supportive, they would normally see young people in care without their natural support network, which is very unusual in our culture. Your natural support network is your family. So people who do not have their natural support network, it's also religiously endorsed. It is a social responsibility for us to look after them and to look after each other. Yes, but especially young people who don't have their natural support network and are seen as orphans.
So people in Jordan in general, it's seen culturally as if a young person doesn't have parents, if a young person's an orphan, if a young person's in need, culturally it would be the norm to help and to support that young person.
Yes.
Okay.
And then, but then on the other hand, you have some people who see these young people as the products of the height of immorality.
Hmm.
Yeah. Especially those who come from unknown families.
And why would they be seen as the height of immorality?
I can get into the cultural context, and if I give you the cultural background, the key characteristics, then we can better understand the two faces of the coin. Yeah?
Sure.
So, you know, the family basically is the cornerstone of society, and the family is patriarchal. So patriarchy prioritizes the rights and dominance of males and older women. We have specific, like, gender roles and relations are predetermined, and they're based on a hierarchical and authoritative character of the of Arabic society. The society is also collective, with deep-rooted values based on very strong notions of honor. So it's been said that the same patriarchal relations and the values that prevail in the Arabic family actually also prevail at work, at school, in religious and political institutions, and, you know, I mean, it's everywhere. It's how people function, basically. We are as diverse as any other population, but these are the underlying principles. So this, of course, then creates a cycle of societal norms and expectations. There becomes an interplay between projecting expectations onto society from the individual family and also societal expectations of individuals and families.
And so the individual starts to embody the morals, the reputation of the entire family.
I mean, I'll get into that, but I just want to give you an example about how like these cycle of expectations, they're actually reflected in our daily interactions and through the use of fictive kinship language. So for more conventional people in Jordan who are of the same generation, they would normally refer to each other as sister or brother, yes? Then whether you're conventional or unconventional, any person who is old enough to be your parent is referred to as uncle or aunt.
Okay.
And, you know, so with or without genuine intentions, we're all meant to be one family. I mean, I could be walking down the street, and if an older woman thinks that I'm not dressed appropriately or not behaving appropriately, she would actually give me a piece of her mind as if she's talking to her daughter.
Right.
And I totally take it. Yeah. So another key characteristic, and that's really important, is that we have a collective identity. So, you know, unlike the West, the concept of self is not autonomous, but it's connected to an in-group, which is your family and your tribe. Yeah, the significance of the individual does not lie in the individual like it is in the West. It's actually the value of the individual lies in being part of a greater and indivisible whole, such as your family and your tribe.
Okay.
We are continuously enmeshed with our families. Now, this has two main implications, and that's where these are where the faces come from, okay? So the first face resulting from that and the collective identity of the patriarchal society is that your family is your main support network, and that brings benefits, of course. So the family usually remains to be the primary safety net, socially, economically, even politically. They're naturally interdependent, both vertically and horizontally. So there's a reciprocation of care between generations. Yes, so my parents care for me well into adulthood. And then I, in turn, when I reach adulthood, I take care of my aging parents. And this is something that actually we take a lot of pride in. And also this means that we have extended transitions, unlike the West. So over here in the Middle East, or I'll talk about Jordan, we usually leave our parental home for three reasons: education, employment, or marriage. And then it's temporary. So if I go away for education, I come back and live with my family.
And this goes for males and females?
Unless you have a legitimate excuse not to, yeah? And for very conventional people, women actually don't leave their parental home until they get married.
Right, not for employment, not for education.
She wants employment, education, she needs to find it near the house.
Okay.
Or where's a place where she can commute to, basically. But of course, it all depends on how conservative the family is and how conservative the community is. So there's a wide range, okay? But anyhow, the point is that whether you're traditional or not, transitions is very much extended. And even if you become financially independent, you still have the social support from your family. So young people in care, they're removed from all of this. And then at 18, they have to live on their own. So they are seriously moving against the tide, both economically and socially.
Because within the cultural norm, there is an infrastructure there through the extended family to support this young person as they transition into adulthood, should it take them 2, 3, 4, 5 years or more.
Yes. I mean, you know, I was in England for 4 years getting my PhD. I'm in my late 30s. I've come back home. But for me, it's a choice, because my parents happen to be very liberal. For others, no. So, you know, it's very odd for them, regardless of how successful they are. But we can talk about that. So the second phase, actually, is that, you know, while your family is your main support network, your family and community can actually be a main threat, and can behave like a law enforcer or a judge. And this brings challenges. So the collective responsibility for the individuals in the family or in the tribe is to protect the unity and honor of the family. The actions of individuals don't actually reflect on the self, but they reflect on the family. So if I do something, I'll be stigmatizing my family. I won't be stigmatizing myself as an individual. That's why the reputation and the needs of the collective unit take precedence over individual needs. Now, family honor is actually based on Bedouin, old Bedouin values, and it's expressed by the generosity of its members, honesty of the individuals, courage and bravery of men, and the sexual purity of females. So there's a range of repercussions for those who are perceived to be dishonoring the family. The families might just decide to conceal the misdeed. They might socially isolate the person but continue to support them. And in extreme cases, I'm sure you've heard of honor crimes.
Yes, certainly.
So children born to unwed mothers are related to those.
To those honor crimes.
They're related to those taboo issues.
Got you.
Yeah, and children in care are related to these taboo issues.
So children in care related to the taboo issues because somehow the reason that they're in care stigmatizes or reflects poorly upon the family?
It stigmatizes them even if the family is not known. Because that's what I meant when I said they're seen as the product of immorality.
Right.
So they are actually blamed and stigmatized for the same reasons that brought them in. And of course, all of these reasons are socially constructed.
Right. So if the parents die, for example, and for whatever reason, other family members are not able to or unwilling to take care of the children, the child grows up in care, they turn 18, they have this number, they go to employer, all of a sudden they become children of more immorality, or the phrase that you use in your writing is a daughter or son of sin. And somehow that, through absolutely no fault of their own, something that happened upon birth or shortly thereafter, they're stigmatized potentially for the rest of their lives.
But I want to clarify something.
Please.
Now, colloquially, we use the term orphan to include different categories of young people in care or care leavers. So that includes true orphans, who are only 22% of the current population in care. But then this also includes young people who were admitted to care due to child abuse and neglect and dysfunctional family dynamics.
Right.
That's 31% of the current population. And then there's those who are admitted to care from unknown families.
Okay. And all of them are given the label of orphan.
But not all of them have the number of 2,000.
And that it depends upon whether or not their parents were known upon birth?
Well, if they were known, yes. If their parents were unknown, that's what I was trying to explain. Those who come from unknown families who were born before 2000, those were the ones who were given that stigmatizing ID.
Right. And so do we see conflicts between the young people from care, those who have the stigmatizing number and those who don't?
No, there's actually a very strong sense of camaraderie. Those who have that number are actually very upset for who they see as their brothers and sisters.
So would you say that sense of family, that sense of community that is so important in culture in general, extends to those young people who grow up in care, that they become each other's family?
For sure, because they have been forced to be individuals in a collective society. And they've had to cope with that somehow. So actually, there are different coping strategies. And one of them is, you can see from the various quotes, and when they, you know, when they discuss their circumstances with me, is that there's a very, very strong sense of camaraderie. They usually, when they're speaking about not themselves as an individual, they refer to each other as we and us, not I. Yeah?
That was very common, yes.
And then another way of coping with the forced individuality is actually through marriage. Another way is through one's birth family, although that was that tended to be the least satisfactory, at least with the young people that I interviewed.
They would return to their birth families upon transitioning out of care?
Yes, a lot of them did.
And what was the result of returning to their families?
Most of them actually eventually left.
Hmm.
Or they formed like a family within a family. You know, some of them would, like two sisters, for example, in care, they stuck to each other. It was very difficult for them to really integrate with their families. But living with the family provided a good social cover, even though they were miserable.
Because they were then accepted in the larger community, larger society as being part of a family.
Saved face.
For everybody.
It saved face for everybody.
Could you tell me a bit about how marriage does play into this then?
Well, marriage, first of all, in our culture is it's a landmark of reaching adulthood. It's a very desired identity, especially for females. It's like almost mandatory. I mean, if you're in your 30s and you're not married, you know, don't be surprised if you hear, what's wrong? Why aren't you married until now?
It was a frequent question I was asked, if I'm married, if I have children. New people I met, I talked to them for 3 minutes, they were asking me about if I was married, if I had children, etc., etc.
Some of these questions are considered to be actually very friendly and breaking the ice.
Right.
Our notions of boundaries are different to that in the West. So if there's anything unusual about you, people will ask even more questions. It's an issue that is actually very difficult for young people who leave care, because these everyday questions are actually a cause of a lot of anxiety for them.
Because the everyday questions of, you know, do you have children? Are you married? You know, who is your parents? Who's your family? Who's your brother? Who's your sister? They don't have the answers to many of these questions.
You know, the value of the individual is it can't be separated from the family. So if, let's say, I meet a person for the first time, it's not unusual for them to say, where are you from? Like, what area? And then they'll ask what family I'm from. And then they'll ask me who my father is, what he does, how many siblings I have. And inquiring about my name could actually be the last question, because they're trying to identify what kin group I come from. So young people who leave care, they don't have that. It's, you know, at least the ones who don't know who their families are. And these are everyday questions. This is something that they have to deal with and they have to encounter every single time they meet a new person.
How do they survive these questions that are constantly being asked of them?
Legitimate lies.
And how do these legitimate lies manifest themselves for these young people?
Well, actually, you know, they form different strategies. First of all, what they try to do is they keep a low profile, yeah? So they avoid asking people questions so that people don't ask them questions. And of course, this results in being isolated and only sticking to each other.
Because they're so afraid of going outside of that community, because people start to ask questions, people will start to realize that they are, the term you're using is orphans, they'll then be stigmatized, they'll be seen as tainted, they'll be seen as daughters or sons of sin, and then be isolated.
Yeah, be rejected, be exploited, you know, there are different implications of being stigmatized. But also, you know, I mean, after a while, it depends. They take their time in disclosing their background to people, and only after they really get to know them and figure out how their mentality is, to try and assess how they might be reacted to as a result. Yeah, but they're very, very cautious.
Sure.
But anyhow, so we were talking about legitimate lies. The use of legitimate lies was a coping strategy for daily interactions to control other people's attitudes towards them.
So how would these what would they say for the lies? They would make up family members, make up siblings?
Everything. And actually, you know, even though they were in closed homes, especially, you know, the ones that I interviewed, because they're not growing up in the same atmosphere that the young people currently are growing up in. The system is improving. For them, especially, they grew up in closed homes that were separate from mainstream society and stigmatized. So, you know, I mean, any residential home is at risk of institutionalizing the children that live there. So that means social deprivation. And that means not knowing what works in what they call the outside world. But what I found really interesting is that with time, and those who were out of care for longer periods of time were actually very savvy, very street smart in terms of identifying what works and what to say to whom. Those who were shorter term care leavers were not as knowledgeable in terms of what works. So their lies were not always good and actually could place them at more risk. But I'll give you an example. One young woman, for example, was living in an apartment on her own. And I told you that it's very unusual for people to be living single like they do in the West, just for the sole reason of wanting to live single. You have to have a legitimate reason because it's very unusual. For both genders, yeah? Now, this young woman told the landlord that she was an orphan, but she was living with her grandmother, and she is Palestinian. Her grandmother had to go back to the West Bank, but she couldn't go back with her because she was a student, and she was working, and she needed to finish the university. Otherwise, she'd lose all her credits if she left now and wanted to enroll at a university in the West Bank. And also she was religious and conventional, you know, she wore the hijab. So she believed that she was seen as a good girl because she was wearing the right stuff, and her lie was legitimate.
How did the person react to the lie? They accepted it, they believed it, and then they let the young woman stay at the apartment?
Yes, for quite some time. Yeah, they didn't put one and one together, according to her words, that she could have been in care.
They didn't put one and one together. And did they develop a friendship of any sort? And was the truth ever revealed to this landlord?
Not with this landlord, but with other people, yes. I mean, actually, with accessing accommodation, a lot of young people struggle because a lot of people here don't like to rent out apartments to single people. They're always going to assume that they're going to be up to no good. And the reputation of the landlords might be tarnished because they would be seen as allowing all of these bad things to happen. And as I said, it's unusual. So access accommodation actually was quite difficult, and the use of legitimate lies, it served well in that.
Why do you call the lies legitimate?
Because they give culturally legitimate stories, but they're lies.
Gotcha. Okay. I want to return to the idea of marriage, because in some of the writing that I've read of yours, you talk about arranged marriages, you talk about care agencies, the government, creating opportunities for particularly the young women to get married. Could you elaborate more about that?
Yeah. So as I started telling you before, marriage is like almost mandatory. Yeah, and especially for females. And it's very unusual for young women to live on their own. So, you know, it depended on the individual female and the individual care home. Marriage was seen providing security for the young lady. She would be in a legitimately desirable position because she's a married young woman. She's not on her own, and she would be taken care of. Now, of course, for some, they were actually pushed into this. For others, they were emotionally driven because they also wanted to create their own family. They were in a hurry to do that.
Right. How were they pushed into it?
They weren't forced, but they were highly encouraged, as one young woman told me. You know, they would tell her, you don't have anyone, where are you going to go? What are your choices? This is your best option. At least you'll be taken care of. You're not going to be on the street, and so on and so forth.
Who would tell her this?
People in the care homes.
Okay, so the staff in the care homes.
Yeah. And this, for this young woman, for example, it actually, he turned out to be an abuser and she ran away from him. So it was a bit of a hit or miss, but there were other young women who met guys along their way, and the guys would come and ask for their hand from the care home like they would if they were living with a family.
And the care home would act as the parents in allowing the marriage, if you will.
Yes. But of course, the ones who were out of care for longer, had more life experience, chose the partners on their own, have better results than those who were emotionally driven.
Unsurprisingly. There's about 6.3 million citizens in Jordan.
Yes.
And a huge amount of them, 73%, are under 30.
Yep.
Yet the estimates of youth in care are somewhere between 800 and 1,800, depending on who you speak to and what you look at. This seems relatively low to me. I know you don't have the current numbers for today. Why do you think the numbers are so low?
Yeah, I mean, actually, if you know, the largest single population is age 30 and under, I think, is 2.2 million, like 40% of the population. So kids currently in care, there's about 1,000,
mm-hmm.
less than 0.5%.
Right.
But, okay, so there, I think there are a combination of factors of why there are so few children in care. One is the cultural role, because preserving the unity of the family is held in very high regard.
Right.
Parents would be shamed in their extended family and community for abandoning their children, regardless of their economic situation. Government regulations have also become more strict in terms of not allowing families to admit their children in care solely due to poor economic standings. So they try to hook them up with other services such as the National Aid Fund. That gives them, that assesses their situation and provides welfare money. But also another issue that professionals here discuss is that the definition of abuse and neglect and reporting is probably a very likely reason of why children are not admitted to care as much as one would think that they should be. Although I'm not advocating that they should be admitted to care. It's a reason of why, main reason of why they're not admitted to care, because, I mean, abuse has to be very severe for children to be removed from families. Corporal punishment is accepted culturally. People are hesitant about interfering with families. So perhaps if our definition and understanding of abuse was similar to that of the West, we may actually have a lot more kids in care. And also reporting is also a serious issue outside of the capital and in more rural areas. They're much more conventional, and the tribal system is even more influential in these areas than it is in the capital. So individuals and professionals are less likely to report abuse, and authorities probably in those areas are hesitant to interfere. It becomes a tribal issue. It becomes a personal issue. They don't care if it's police.
Right. And within a tribal context or a different community context outside of the capital, would there be resources provided for families, and not necessarily state resources, but tribal resources to help support the parents to decrease or eliminate the abuse?
They can, you know. I mean, part of a strong culture within the tribal system is actually mediation. And, you know, as I said before, part of the system is to, or the collective identity, you know, you protect your own. You're their main support network. But often it doesn't happen. And also, you know, it all depends on their own understanding and definition of abuse.
Yeah. You write that more than 70% of the people in care are female.
Yes, at that time.
Do you have a sense of why it's so disproportionately female?
I thought it was really odd too, but I've been checking out the numbers, and currently it's actually 57% males and 43 females.
Okay. So that was mostly had to do with your sample?
It changes according to, it varies from year to year.
When I was at the fourth circle, the vast majority of the people there were males. And so I was reflecting on your article thinking, I wonder why there was such a different representation.
Yeah, actually, those, the number that you read in the article, those were official stats about people in care at that time. But it would be very odd if that remained constant and very contradictory to the culture, because women and girls are supposed to be protected even more so than males. Males are expected to rough it up, admit their children into care. They would rather admit the boys rather than the girls.
When I was with the young people and we would have conversations, and they eventually found out what I did, that one of the things I do is I teach people how to be youth workers. They all applauded me, which was quite surprising. And when I asked them why, they said the staff at the homes where they lived had no training. What is the situation for educating people to work with children and youth in Jordan?
In short, two words, very bad.
Right.
You know, unfortunately, yes, most people who work in care homes are not qualified, actually.
Hmm.
And, you know, this is a reflection of a challenge that we're facing in the country, if not the region. Social work education is, you know, there are only two universities that have social work education, even though, so most people who are in social work positions have sociology degrees.
Okay.
Sociology degrees, you're not going to study about child development.
No.
You're not going to study about youth development. You're not going to study about children in care. And also training could be very much improved. But so this is a challenge on a national level, actually.
Is there any movement towards increasing the education of people who work with children and youth across the country?
There's the need for social work education, or to improve social work education, is finally increasing on the political agenda. Then that should have an influence on the quality of care and people who work with children and youth, hopefully in the not too distant future.
Right. Yes, hopefully. Rowan, I want to thank you very, very much for taking the time today. I want to thank you immensely for speaking with me when I was in Jordan, informing me about the protests of the young people. I found my time with them incredibly enlightening and heartbreaking at moments, and delightful in so many ways. So just before we wrap up, is there anything else that you would like to say before we end this conversation?
I'd like to come see you teach.
That would be wonderful.
It was really great for me to be able to speak to a professional who is, you know, very much involved in the same field as I am. I don't have a lot of people to talk to about children and care and care leavers.
Right.
It was nice. Usually I have to leave the country to do that. So really great for me, and I'm really glad that you reached out. I'm very grateful.
Yes, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Take care of yourself.
You too.